Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you first for that wonderful introduction. I need to thank John Seely Brown, who is the indirect way that I got here. I knew that John was involved in the center. I didn't know much about the center until meeting Jennifer about an hour ago. And the minute she started to talk about the work that was being done here, I said, aha, now I know why John's involved. And was really excited to be able to be here to talk to you. And I got the extra, I'm a Southern California girl who moved to Northern California, and I got the extra special treat of spending the day at the beach yesterday, which having moved up to Northern California is the thing that I miss the most. So it's been wonderful being here in Santa Barbara, and it's nice to get a chance to share some of my ideas and the concerns and passions that led me to write this book. And it's interesting because, the term innovation, when I was arguing with my publishers over the title of the book, I actually didn't even want to put innovation in the title because the word has become such a soundbite at this point. And when you talk about innovation, talk about change, it's become even more of a soundbite. But what I'm talking about here is actually not innovation, but sustainable innovation. And you'll see in a minute why I put the word sustainable in front of it. And because innovation is not a soundbite, and it's not just a trend. I spoke on a panel about a year ago. I was in the middle of writing my book. And someone from Google was on the panel, someone from Cisco was a number of technologists. And the guy from Google came onto the panel and said, you know, I looked at the statistics of how often the term innovation is searched for over the last 10 years or so. And he started to describe this cyclical nature of people's interest in innovation and then not interested and interested. And his point in some ways was that innovation is a fad, that all of a sudden people become very concerned about innovation and then a couple years later, they're not so concerned about innovation. And I remember walking away from that saying, no, I don't, it may be a fad in many people's mind, but I don't accept that. And the fact of the matter is real innovation, and I'll talk about what I mean by real innovation and sustainable innovation, really matters. It is, it's too bad that it's become a soundbite, because understanding and investing in and embracing real innovation matters today more than it ever has. It clearly drives our economy. I think that anybody who has studied economic cycles knows that every major economic cycle we've had in this country began with something new, something disruptive, and in the, clearly whether it's the cell phone or the internet or the personal computer, the discovery of DNA and our DNA, all of those things drove major economic cycles. It also impacts the quality of our life. So whether it is medical care or entertainment, the life that we enjoy is driven by innovation. But as important as either of those things are the major challenges that we face now as a country, as a society, as a planet. And from energy dependence to climate change to security to healthcare, you can go on and on and on. It's really only innovation and innovative approaches to look at those problems, looking at these problems in new ways that we have any hope of addressing them. But innovation doesn't just happen. And this is one of my biggest concerns with it having become a soundbite is that we now take innovation for granted in this country. And it doesn't just happen. It needs to be nurtured. And in fact, the culture in America and the culture in the business community, as well as in society and in Washington, has become extremely short-sighted. And if you are just thinking about this week, this quarter, this year, then significant sustainable innovation is the loser. And I talk about having an innovation deficit, not just a budget deficit, in that we're reaping the benefits of seeds that were planted over the last decades, but we are not planting enough seeds to get us where we need to get in the future. Now, very often I have people then say to me, come on, Judy, look at all of the innovation around us. And yes, there is a lot of innovation around us, from the iPod to Web 2.0 and to new pharmaceuticals. But it's not enough, and a lot of the innovation that we are focused on today is incremental in nature. One of the quotes in my book that I like the best is I was interviewing Marc Andreessen, who is as most people know, was the developer of the browser, and I was asking him how he managed to get it to market so quickly. And he just looked at me and said, you know, Judy, the browser that I wrote was the icing on a cake that had been baking for 30 years. And it's true. It was really what took us over the edge in terms of making all of this technology usable. But it was the icing on the cake. And if the cake had not been baking for 30 years, there's no way that that could have changed the world the way it did. Well, you know what? We are not baking new cakes. We are just putting more and more layers of icing on the cakes that have been baking. And this is something that we have to change. So let me talk, the first part, I'm going to talk a little bit about the framework that I present in the book in terms of talking about innovation. Because when I started going to different audiences, before I even had thought about writing a book, and was discussing innovation with scientists, with business people, with educators, I found that everybody thought innovation was something different. And so one of the first things that I felt was that it was important to put a framework in place, let people understand what is common across truly innovative environments and truly innovative people. Because there is no rule book for innovation, but there are some common themes that go across innovation. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about how it applies to the business world. And then I'd like to talk about how it applies to us nationally in terms of our national ecosystem or situation today. So let me just start off with a few just basic fundamentals of innovation. The first is that there are multiple types of innovation, and I've already kind of alluded to this, which is there is incremental innovation, which is making something incrementally better. There is breakthrough innovation, which is coming up with something completely new, although I will say that nothing is completely new anymore. All innovation builds off of innovation, but something more significant, i.e. the cell phone, or the packet switching and the notion of networking computers together is more breakthrough innovation, or the discovery of DNA. And then actually, I introduced a term in my book because it didn't seem to me that incremental and breakthrough covered it all, which is the notion of orthogonal innovation, which I think is going to become more and more important as we go forward. And that is taking the technologies that exist, but applying them differently. And the reason I called it orthogonal, it's kind of turning things on their head, to be able to say, well, if I look at this problem differently, I can come up with something actually quite disruptive, but it's not quite breakthrough in terms of breakthroughs in technology and innovation. And the iPod is, to me, the perfect example of orthogonal innovation. There was nothing new technologically about the iPod. It was the idea of a new way to experience music, of iTunes and iPod and the ease of use and the styling that really made the breakthrough in terms of that, that technology. Now, I'm not placing any judgment on these different types of innovation. We need all of them. But the important thing is we need a balance across them. You can't just have incremental innovation. You can't just have breakthrough. You need breakthrough innovation to create new market cycles, new discoveries in fields of science, and then it's incremental innovation that makes it better and better and better and elongates the market or for a business makes their products even better. So there's an important element here. You'll hear me say this word multiple times through this talk is balance. And when we get out of balance is when we get in trouble, and you need a balance of these three types of innovation. The second concept, which is anybody who's been involved in innovation knows, but we forget, and the people who fund innovation too often don't recognize this, which is innovation is messy. It's iterative and it's messy. And when you are going through the process of identifying needs, framing questions, trying new things, assessing and learning whether or not what you tried works. You may have to go through this loop, and those are the arrows going back on that green picture on the side, multiple times, all the way to the beginning. Maybe you had the wrong need. Maybe you were framing the question wrong. Maybe the idea you had was wrong. And if you're really innovating, you have no idea how many times you're going to go through that cycle. So it's iterative and messy. And you know what? CFOs and managers don't like messiness. And so you have to accept in an environment that if you really want to embrace broader sustainable innovation, somewhere in your organization, the whole organization doesn't have to be messy, but there have to be places in your organization where you tolerate messiness. You need to be willing to invest without knowing the outcome. And that, again, is very hard for people in traditional business models or in a culture where we want instant gratification for everything. So it's very important to embrace this concept of messiness and being willing to invest in something that's going to fail, and I'll come back to this. The last point I want to make about innovation, and I talk a lot about this in my book, but again, I'm just trying to give you some snapshots here, is talent really, really matters. There are people who are innovative, and there are people who are just naturally not as innovative. People think differently. They've been trained differently. And when I talk about talent here, I'm talking about the combination of skill, aptitude, passion, and drive, and don't ever underestimate the passion part of that, because that is a lot of what drives innovation. Innovation thrives in teams. It is no longer about single people in a garage making an invention. Our problems are too complex. Our problems are too interdisciplinary. But the interesting thing about teams that we historically have not thought as much about and now is becoming more and more important, and the center is a good example of this, is the importance of diversity in these teams. And whether it's in a board of directors or a team of innovators or a center in a university, diversity doesn't mean what it used to be. I'm not talking about race, I'm not talking about sex, I'm talking about cognitive diversity. And so having people with diverse experiences and diverse perspectives coming together is really magic when you can bring them together in the right way. So when you're thinking about talent and innovation, you really want to get away from the notion there's a difference between fairness and uniformity. I'll talk about this in a minute. But getting the best talent does make a difference when it comes to innovation and the notion of teams and diversity. Now, when I started writing my book, I really wanted to come up with a way to think about innovation that was not just about a product or a service. And many people, a few people that I interviewed, and I interviewed over 100 people for my book, a few of them said to me, you know, Judy, the definition of innovation, and it was interesting because I asked people what they thought the definition of innovation was, and a few of them told me that definition of innovation was an idea that you brought to market, that it had to successfully become a product or a service for it to be innovation. And I had a problem with that because I actually think that failure is a critical part of the cycle of innovation. And if you only define something as innovation, if it is a successful product, you leave out a whole part of the innovation system. So I started to think about how could I describe innovation more broadly and not just about products and services, and how did I bring in the notion of how important the use of science and technology was, not just the development of it. And I came up with one day the notion of an innovation ecosystem. Now, those of you who are from the business world, throw out your definition of ecosystem, because in the business world, an ecosystem is a set of partnerships. It's who you deal with, it's your vendors, it's your suppliers, it's your customers. I'm not talking about that type of ecosystem. I'm actually talking about an analogy to a biological ecosystem. And I must admit, I had to go back and look up the definition. It's been a long time since I learned about ecosystems in science in school. And so what's the definition of a biological ecosystem? It's the dynamic interaction between living organisms and their environment. But An important aspect of it is a biological ecosystem must be in balance to sustain life. So if you're out of balance in a biological ecosystem, such as climate change throwing our planet's ecosystem out of balance, it can't sustain life. And it was that part that really resonated with my notion about innovation. So what are the organisms? What are the communities in an innovation ecosystem? There are three main communities. There's the research community, and the job of the research community or the output of the research community is furthering understanding, discoveries, and as important of either of those, training young minds. The being involved in the research community is actually how we train a lot of people to think that then go on to other communities or stay in the research community. The second community is the development community. This is where new products or services are developed, whether it's innovating in advanced technology or innovating in process. So Intel, obviously one of the great companies in the technology industry, innovated in products, but some of their greatest innovation actually was in process, was in their manufacturing process. And that's really been a lot of their success. And then there's the application community. And a lot of people forget about the application community when it comes to innovation, but that's where you apply science and technology in new ways. So the healthcare industry is in the application community. Any user of technology, a consumer, is in the application community. Let me give you just two examples to drive these community homes. One is a organizational example, and the framework that I'm talking about actually applies to organizations as well as nationally or globally. So let's just look at a company like Google. Google started off in the research community with an interesting new algorithm for how to do search. They then spun out as a company and developed a search engine, a very interesting, innovative product. But what really made Google successful was their innovation in the application community with new business models for tying advertising to search and how to build IT infrastructures that allowed them to scale in the way that they can. So here is one company that actually had kind of went through all of the communities of the ecosystem. There are other companies that live in one of these communities and need to reach out and have relationships between the others. Another example is let's take a look at one of our global challenges, which is the combination of needing to achieve energy independence coupled with reversing climate change. Well, we need behavioral modification in the application community, and we need to start that now. We need new products, either that are more energy efficient, hybrid cars or computers that use less energy, or solar panels that are more affordable and more scalable. But we also need to be investing in research to both understand the problems better as well as find alternative forms of energy that will be affordable and scalable. So when we look at some of these problems and look at our investment or our policies for the global issues we face, we need to, again, make sure that we are balanced across these communities of the ecosystem. And as a company, you need to understand where your core strengths are, where you live in this ecosystem, and then make sure that you have connections to the other communities. Because the same way nutrients go between organisms in a biological ecosystem, needs and questions flow between the communities of the innovation ecosystem. And that connection between them and something like the center here is really making sure that the application community has feedback to development and research, and that you don't just have a one-way circle, and you really need multi-way connections. These arrows are bidirectional on purpose. So I mentioned the second part of an ecosystem, which is not just these organisms, but the interaction of the organisms with their environment. So in a biological ecosystem, it's sunshine, it's water. What are the environmental factors for innovation? Leadership, funding, policy, education, and culture. And those five environmental factors have the ability to encourage innovation or the ability to very quickly stifle innovation. Again, in an organization, leadership is obviously leadership. Funding is how you allocate your budget. Policy is what are the procedures of the organization. Education is the training of your employees. And culture is the organizational culture. If you look at the country, funding is, are we funding research? How do the VCs act? How does Wall Street act? So where are the funding sources and the behavior of those sources? Policy is obviously national, state, local type of policy. Education is educating our youth, and culture is the culture of society. Now, the two most important are leadership and culture. And that is because if you have the right leadership, in general, the funding, policy, and education, you'll make the right decisions for those. But it is very clear, and I'll come back to this a couple times, that innovation is not a top-down process, but it's not just a bottom-up process. You need leadership to spark and support and inspire innovation, and you need, and maybe really what you need leadership to do is not kill innovation, because people and kids are naturally innovative, but more often than that, what we do is spend our time stifling that bottom-up process. So let me talk a little bit about culture. One of the things that, when I thought back to every environment that I had been involved in terms of the small companies that I was involved in building, the incredibly innovative companies that I sit on the board of, Disney and FedEx, the people that I interviewed and interact with from Silicon Valley to across the world, this seems simplistic, but it isn't. There are five what I call core values that are consistent across environments that I have seen that create innovation. So the first one is questioning. I think no one would question whether or not curiosity drives innovation. So innovation comes from, how do I do this better? What if? Why isn't this? All types of questions, and how you frame a question is really critical. If you frame a question, when is this going to get done, you're not going to get the same broad thinking out of people than you frame a question of, tell me what you're doing. What's your next step? What problems are you trying to solve? What obstacles are you finding? Those are questions that will get people to think more broadly and communicate than ones that are more judgmental. But there's a dual part of questioning. It's not just about curiosity, and it's not just about framing questions. It's about self-assessment. And this is something that often people forget that is a critical part of innovation, which is you don't need to just, in the book I talk about innovators as being critical optimists. You need this combination between incredible passion and optimism and tenacity that's going to allow you get over all of the hurdles that are thrown your way. But you know what? If you don't have that self-doubt, if you don't have that willingness to self-assess and question yourself, you'll innovate right into a wall. And you always need to be willing to question and adapt. Second one is risk. And what does risk mean? Everybody talks about risk. It's a willingness to be vulnerable, to fail, to try something that may not work, to learn from failure, to fail early and fail often as opposed to hiding failure and then taking it too long and it becoming a disaster as opposed to something you can learn from. The third is openness, to imagine, to share. Innovation thrives with collaboration and sharing. Open to surprise. What that means is you think you're working on one thing and a result pops up over here. If you're not open, you won't even notice it. And many of the great innovations that have come about have actually come from someone saying, wait a minute, what's that piece of data and what does it mean? And, you know, from discoveries of penicillin to drugs like Viagra came from someone saying, what does that data mean and what does it tell me, and being open to surprise. Patience in an innovator is tenacity. In a leader or a funder is patience. You just got to let things grow sometimes. You have to give things time to see if they're going to work. And then trust. You have to trust in yourself. You have to trust in others. Because without trust in the environment, it's very hard to be vulnerable. You don't let yourself be vulnerable to failure if you don't trust. Now, an interesting thing, here comes the word balance again, is you don't get to pick one of these and say, you know what, I take risk, I'm innovative. You have to have all of these in balance, and let me give you two examples. If you have trust without questioning, that's blind faith. And blind faith does not encourage innovation. It encourages people just to do what you tell them to do. But a probably more relevant example today is if you have risk without questioning and without openness, you end up with today's economic crisis. And the risk that was taken without asking questions on what the risk was, without the transparency to even know what the risk was, then led to a lack of being able to trust who you could even trade with, essentially a breakdown, and I won't even mention patience since there's no patience in the system to begin with, but it led to a breakdown of our economic system. So these five core values are really, really important. And if people ask me about from education to leading organizations to making policy, if there's one message that I'd like to get out there from my book, if people could remember these core values and before they make a decision or a law or a curricula for their kids, they would say, am I encouraging these five core values or am I discouraging these core values? Then I will have made my point. Because if you keep these in mind and you think about the things like closing down on immigration, what does that do? We don't share as much. Or efficiency in companies to cut costs and be more productive. It takes all of the room out of those companies for surprises. So the culture of an organization or a person really wants to embody these five core values. And there's a whole bunch of ways where we every day kill these, and I won't go through all of these because of time, but process and structure and tight efficiency tend to close things off and not leave room for innovation. There are many forces that work against risk-taking and incentive systems, lack of trust. If you think about the research environment, if it's good to have a scarcity of resources, if you think about grant money these days, a scarcity of resources creates healthy competition. If it's too scarce, then people take the safest route, and they no longer are willing to take risks. So there's a very delicate balance in terms of this notion of scarcity of resources. Barriers to open classification of data by the government, commercial classification, which is companies investing in research and then wanting it to be tied up or reading things before they're published, all of those types of things tend to have a negative impact on innovation. And all of these enemies of innovation are true at the organizational level, but they also are true at the national level. So when we think of policies like No Child Left Behind is a good example of an over-focus on accountability and metrics that backfired in terms of innovation. And I'll come back to this. So I talked a little bit about culture. Let me talk in the organizational realm about leadership for a minute. You know, one of the things that happened in the 70s and 80s is businesses started to focus more and more on efficiency and productivity. And customer satisfaction, all very important things. And techniques like Six Sigma swept companies. And Six Sigma has a term where they train people to be black belts or brown belts so that you have people throughout the organization who can go around and make sure that everybody understands what to measure and how to detect defaults. And the whole idea is to take any variation and any default out of the system. And so I was thinking about that term, and I realized that for disruptive and breakthrough innovation, it's actually not like karate. It's more like gardening. And so you don't need a black belt. What you need is a green thumb. And the reason you need a green thumb is when you're leading innovation, and again, this is the more longer-term innovation, you have to make decisions without hard data. It is more about instinct and judgment dealing with ambiguity and having the patience to let something grow, which is very, very different than what we teach when we teach best practice management techniques and things like Six Sigma. Now, you can say to me, Judy, you're being awfully naive. A big company has to support their customers. You have to produce products that don't have deviations. What do you do? Well, you can innovate at scale, but what you can do at scale, and mainstream businesses need to be managed tightly, they're a little bit more like factory farms. They want to produce rows and rows and rows of corn with no defects, no surprises. And incremental innovation can be managed very well in these large organizations. FedEx has something called the Purple Promise, where every FedEx employee wakes up every day and thinks about, how do I make the customer experience better? How do I make an excellent customer experience? That is incremental innovation and is absolutely critical to the service that FedEx provides and makes it, and to their competitiveness. So I'm not taking away from incremental innovation. But in this type of environment, you're not going to get the innovation that creates future growth. And for those types of innovation, I believe you have to create greenhouses or small gardens in which surprises are welcome and there is room to innovate. Now, this is not going back to the models of the past where you had big corporate labs up on the hill that were isolated from the business. These are smaller teams, and they might be in your company or it might be partnering with research groups in universities or with small ventures. But you need to somehow have, and the walls are more porous, but you need to have places where innovation can thrive in terms and can be nurtured, and places where you manage the company at scale. And those two organizations are managed differently. One is for process and efficiency, and the other is to nurture innovation. So let me just switch, and I'm going to finish off by talking a little bit about the national ecosystem and then take questions. Businesses can't exist in a vacuum. You have to really, businesses exist within the confines or are constrained by the policies and the culture of the world that they live in. And if you think about our national ecosystem, it's been in decline since the 70s. And if you look at the places where innovation has happens, it happens in the research environment, it happens in startups, in large corporations. And if you don't get it already, these are leaves that are dying. So the green is good, the yellow is not so good, and the brown is... we've kind of fallen off a cliff. And actually, the three chapters in my book that I talk about this evolution are called Inspirational Innovation, Narrowing Horizons, and I forgot the chapter of my own book, Losing Our Balance. So you can see that I don't exactly believe that we've gone in the right direction. And innovation and research thrived in the 50s and 60s after World War II. The leaders of this nation really reacted to the Cold War and Sputnik by embracing science, by rallying the country around science and innovation. But starting in the 70s and on, research funding, not just the amount, but the way it was allocated, started to shift. Innovation in startups was great through the 80s. Now, a lot of people look at me and say, wait a minute, Judy, the lead-up, the 90s were incredible. The bubble was incredible innovation. No, the bubble made incredible amount of money. But towards the end of the 90s, as we kind of accelerated out of control, it became about money. It didn't become about innovation to change the world. And that was a critical shift in the technology community. In large corporations in the 70s, it started to tighten up as people started to focus on efficiency again and started to take... stop investing in the future. And the environmental factors were kind of mixed through the 90s. In 2000, we had the bursting of the bubble, or 2000, 2001, we had the bursting of the bubble, the discovery of corporate scandals, and the tragedy of 9/11. The combination of those three things, but more important, the way the leadership of the country reacted to those three things, created a disaster for innovation. Because The reaction was for the whole country to become more risk-averse. The Wall Street business community interaction, shareholder activism, putting pressure on boards to then become more adversarial with their management team because everybody was asking, where was the board in the case of something like Enron? The venture entrepreneurial cycle became more adverse and more risk-averse. And the leaders of the nation, instead of taking 9/11 and using that as a rallying cry to connect the dots with our energy dependence and start thinking about how we solve some of these problems, we were told to be afraid because there are these bad guys out there, but to keep shopping. And essentially, instead of rallying the nation, people were left, were asked to just continue to go about their day-to-day basis. So what do we need if those question marks in 2010, they can't be green by 2010. These problems are too hard. It would be nice if they would be turning yellow as opposed to being brown. So the first thing we have to do is acknowledge change because we can't go back to the way things were in the 60s. It just, life is different today. And we need to acknowledge change, and some of that change we need to embrace. And we need to embrace globalization. It is not us versus, it is and. A lot of people ask me whether the gap in the name of my book, The Innovation Gap, is us versus China or us versus the rest of the world. And actually, it's not. I don't spend a lot of time in my book comparing us to the rest of the world. To me, it's the gap between where we are today and where we were, and where we are today and where we need to be and what our potential is as a country. That's the gap that we need to reverse because we want the whole world to be innovative. What we don't want is for everybody else to be innovative and for us to continue our decline. That leaves us in a very weak position. We need to embrace the accelerated pace while still analyzing and thinking. We cannot use the fact that everything is moving so quickly as an excuse not to think, not to put thought in things. We've raised a generation in the business world and even now our kids of PowerPoint thinkers. PowerPoint is a tool to take your ideas and communicate them to other people. You should not think in terms of PowerPoint bullets, and many people do today. After giving this, not this presentation, but giving presentations on innovation for a year, I sat down to write a book, and it was never more clear to me the difference between having to write something down and having to put something in a presentation and how much more thought and analysis has to go into it. But, you know, you start a company today in Silicon Valley, no one asks for a business plan. They ask for a PowerPoint deck. And there's a big difference in terms of that thought process. And then the internet and the web, obviously, is something to embrace and a major change in our life. And then the fact that problems have gotten harder, more complex, more interdisciplinary, and we need to recognize that as we look at innovation. There are a couple of changes, though, that I'm not willing to accept, and I think we have to figure out how to combat, and they're hard. One of them is we have something I call a lab gap, which is we used to have corporations that had research labs that filled the gap between what you could do in university research and products that you could invest in and scale. And Xerox PARC, Bell Labs are great examples of places where you could try things at scale. You could iterate on them. You could build 100 machines and network them together and see whether they worked. Now, the reason we're not, the lab gap hasn't hit us as hard is in the software industry, you don't need labs like that to scale. You can go have Google go from a university to a startup. But if you're looking at alternative energies, if you're looking at life sciences, if you're looking at new hardware technologies, you need those labs, and we don't have them today. And we have to figure out a way to have corporations and academia work together because so much of research is now on the shoulders of academia. We have to figure out a way to get these labs built in a more distributed fashion, but we need a way for them to exist. The vanishing middle class in this country has changed, in my opinion, the paradigm of what used to be what's good for business versus populist. That was an either or. It's not an either-or anymore. What's good for business over the long term is the same way we've benefited here from the middle class growing in China and India and all over the world. At the same time, our middle class has been disappearing. We need a healthy middle class or we're not going to have consumers in the U.S. And we need a healthy middle class or we're not going to have trained employees. So what's good for people is good for business over the long term. And we're so used to being polarized. We are so used to thinking what's good for business is not the populist view. If you have a populist view, you're anti-business. Those two views over the long term have to come together. We need to combat this short-sightedness that anything that's not immediately useful is viewed as waste. I talked about that before. And the other thing that has happened over the last 8 years is an anti-science, anti-intellectual focus in this country. And it's becoming stronger and stronger, whether it is not investing in scientific research, but it's actually a lack of respect for scientific evidence in decision making. And that trickles down. That trickles down to society when you see how decisions are made. And when we raise our kids today, they not only do we need some of them to be scientists and engineers and view science as heroes, we need every one of them to be scientifically literate, because you can't make decisions today about your own health or how to vote without having a basic you can't make good decisions about your health or how to vote unless you have that basic respect for science. So what do we need as we look forward? Before I talked about leaders and culture, so let me just talk a little bit about leadership and a little bit about culture, and then I'll stop. So what do we need in terms of next generation leaders? And it's interesting that if you go talk to any leader in, or actually not just leaders, most people, they will tell you that crisis creates action, that people are not going to do anything differently unless there is a crisis. A lot of leaders will tell you that you need to use competitive threats to really get a company going. Well, there are two ways that you can deal with threats in terms of leadership. One way is to take the threat, and I alluded to this earlier, make that threat apparent to the people in a company or a country, and whether it's competition or terrorists, they then are scared by that threat. But if that is all you do, and you do not ask those people or inspire them to get involved, they are afraid and helpless. And you know what? Afraid and helpless turns off the leadership or executive function in your brain, and then you have people who will just do what they're told. You don't have innovators. So what is the opposite of that? The leadership style that we need in business and in the country is our leaders who can take that threat and convert that threat into a challenge and use that challenge to inspire people to get involved and inspire people to and turn on that leadership function so that we have a country of innovators. And we have been led for the last 8 years through fear. And the psyche of the nation is impacted by that. We need to convert this because the grand challenges we have are there. And when I was interviewing people, many people said, you know, Judy, we don't have Sputnik. We need another Sputnik. And I would say, are you kidding? We have four or five things that are equivalent to Sputnik. Now, they're not as simple. So the leaders after World War II responded in the right way by inspiring. They had something that was a little bit easier, which was the circling satellite with a beacon that everybody could feel that it was there. So energy dependence, climate change, those things are not as simple to understand, but if you have the right leadership, then you can get people to understand it. And you can use it to rally the nation. Let's look at the economic crisis. After everything completely fell apart, one of the VC firms in Silicon Valley sent out a memo that says, you know what, good times are over, every one of our CEOs should cut 20% of their companies, created complete panic in the valley. Is that the way you take the threat of the economy going down? No. What you do is you take that and you go to your companies and you say, you know what, it's going to be hard for a couple of years, but let's figure out together how you extend your runway. How do you keep investing in R&D for the future while wisely cutting where you need to cut? So there is, it's that different approach in leadership of taking those challenges. And in hard times, I've had multiple people over the last couple of weeks say, Judy, it was fine for you to talk about innovation a month ago, but how do you expect anybody to invest in the future with the economic crisis? And my answer is, I was concerned before, I'm even more concerned now, but we need it even now, more now, because it is our only way out of the situation we're in, is by thinking about this and talking about it and investing and acting in the right way. And we need this from our national leadership, our state leadership, our local leadership, our parents, our mentors. So when I talk about leadership, it starts at the top, but it's every one of us. And again, I've mentioned this, but we have a whole set of challenges. Each of them deserve their own moonshot, and we should be viewing them that way. When we reacted to Sputnik, we did not just build a bigger rocket. We rallied around a broad range of scientific programs to get people involved. And the answers for specifically, if you take the combination of energy and climate change, is not just about alternative energy, but it is a broad range of initiatives that include the whole country and can really create not just jobs, but again, change the psyche of a generation. So let's talk about the next generation of innovators, because this is actually harder, I think, than the first problem, which is not only is our education system broken, but our culture is broken in terms of working for innovation as opposed to against innovation. And it mainly because we've become so focused on instant gratification. There's been a lot of focus on greed over the last couple of years. Again, our education system has gone backwards over the last 8 years with things like No Child Left Behind. So what do we need when we look at 21st century talent? We need to be educating and parenting and mentoring our kids to be collaborative, to be adaptive, to be interdisciplinary as opposed to too narrowly focused. To be scientifically and technologically literate. And then something that sometimes backfires on me when I talk to certain crowds, but I'll glance and see the age distribution in this crowd. We actually need to be thinking about how do we get the best of the baby boomers and Gen X, Y, millennial, whatever you want to talk about, the younger generation. And the reason I put this up here is there's been lots of talk lately about young adults graduating, coming into the workplace, incredible use skills at use of technology that will really benefit the workplace. And whether it's the workplace or young researchers in academia, also fresh new ideas. And there's nothing like youth coming through to make a university or a company more innovative. But we have a problem. We have a couple generations who have been brought up in the era, again, of instant gratification, Google for an answer, PowerPoint type of thinking. And really, when I hear consultants on 60 Minutes or write articles, what they're doing is they're consulting with companies and telling companies how to change to adapt themselves to the new millennials. Well, yes, but no. Because what we can't lose is what the baby boomers had, which is, and I am a baby boomer, which is being trained in scientific thinking and actually taking the time to think and having a little bit more patience. And so whether it, again, is in academia where you really want to pair the scientists that have been around for a while with the fresh new students, you don't want to just go all the way in the other direction. So this notion of mentoring and trying to, we're at an interesting time right now where we really have a chance to blend these two generations. And we can only do that if companies and organizations give it a chance and make a conscious decision to do it. And on that note, let me just say that I talked a lot about leadership and I talked a lot about culture. And the fact of the matter is that leadership is all over the place. So I mentioned national leadership, I mentioned business leadership, but there's not a person in this room that doesn't play a leadership role within their family, their community, their department in a university, their company, their circle of friends. And so I'd just like to say that people often ask me, some writer wrote a mention about my book, and I liked part of it, the other part of it I didn't, which is he called it a marvelous but depressing read. I liked the marvelous part, but I didn't like the depressing part. And I think it's because I'm hopeful. I don't know why I'm hopeful, because we've got a lot of big problems, and it's going to take a long time, and we need a real commitment to solve them. But I'm hopeful because I believe that if we can take it seriously, we really can address them. It's going to come bottom up. It's going to take time. But I think with the right leadership and the willingness to spark and put the right programs in the place, that it can happen.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.